November is Native American Heritage Month around the country. Depending upon where you live, the observances may be numerous or they may be few and far between. The University of Oregon's observance of the month includes bringing in artist and activist Chinupa Hanska Luger for a brief residency. He was raised at Standing Rock and currently lives in New Mexico, and he creates art in several different media, including something called seed bombs. Don't worry, it's not an explosive thing, but it blends art and nature in a unique way. Teaching the making of seed bombs is among the activities planned for tomorrow at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the U of O between noon and 5. We're pleased to have the teacher join us by phone, Chinupa Hanska Luger. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning.
Good morning. So Standing Rock is not a hashtag or a movement, I saw you say in an earlier speaking engagement. Do people fundamentally misunderstand something about Standing Rock, even if they stand with you on the pipeline and similar issues?
Well, I think through media and the sharing of it, using the tools of hashtagging and whatnot, people tend to forget that it's geography, you know? It's geology. It's a place, you know? And my question is, do you know where that place ends and the place that you stand begins? You know, when we're talking about a location on the surface of the earth, you know, which is round. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm interested in people recognizing the interconnection of spaces rather than limiting them to, you know, some sort of movement.
You've gone through quite an evolution of this in your own life, it sounds like, in your thinking about land and owning it and all those concepts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm hyper aware of, you know, an indigenous worldview. I had the privilege of growing up and learning from my elders, like proper protocols around relationships to land. And one of the things that I think is most interesting and quite possibly becoming more and more relevant to our 21st century experience is that we need to create a relationship with the land that is one of reverence rather than one of resource.
In other words, stop looking at the land for what it can give us and think in terms of perhaps what we can give to it.
Yeah, and moreover, like, you know, can we reestablish the fact that we are extensions of it, you know, and can we treat each other as we treat, can we treat the land the way we treat each other, and can we learn by that respect to actually respect one another even more, you know?
Had your thoughts about land evolved completely by the time you started working in art, or have these come later? I mean, I'm just kind of figuring out, what, you know, sort of which came first in your life.
I think the relationship to place and the land is something that's, you know, just embedded culturally, basically. Trying to be able to describe it within English terms has been something that I kind of had to work towards. There was a lot of de-learning things in order to get to a space that I was comfortable to articulate, like the nuances and the beauty of some of our customary practices. You know, the cosmologies that exist there, there's embedded within those cosmologies beautiful, beautiful science. And it's a way of experiencing the world that doesn't lose meaning in the description.
So when you talk about de-learning things, is that because you had a fairly standard, you know, American education?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a public school kid. I was also, you know, born in 1979. So I, you know, grew up eating cereal with too much sugar and watching MTV, you know, Nickelodeon, like that whole 21st century experience is a part of the canon that is my life, you know?
Did you have to go back then and sort of pick up the parts that you hadn't acknowledged before? I mean, I'm looking at your background here. You're of descent from Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara, Lakota, Austrian, and Norwegian descent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of those people actually live in the Dakotas. So what I am is somebody born of that place, you know? All of the horror and the glory that has happened in the Dakotas is actually manifest in my genetics.
And to some degree in your artwork, too. We're talking to Chinupa Hanska Luger here on the Jefferson Exchange, visiting the University of Oregon this weekend. A number of events, including a five-hour session tomorrow at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History between noon and 5. You can join the conversation here on the Exchange as we talk about the subjects that are raised by his art and his life. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And in look, it's really hard to describe your art on the radio because it's in many forms and works on many levels with many materials. When did you start creating?
I believe it's something I probably did my whole life. My mother is an artist and my father is a cowboy. And so I'm somewhere in the middle distance of that space. One thing that I am acutely aware of is that I was born with the privilege of knowing what hard work is. And I look at a lot of my peers, you know, a lot of my people born in my lifetime, and the knowledge of what hard work looks like is something lacking. And so I grew up with it and took it, you know, for granted, really. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized I knew what effort looked like.
Does that pay off in your artwork? I mean, given how old you are, which is not very compared to me anyway, we've got 20 years between us, but the fact that you've created a lot of stuff and in a lot of different media, I mean, has that hard work paid off in allowing you to be that productive?
Absolutely. And also, you know, I grew up and my dad has a ranch in Fort Yates in Standing Rock. I don't know how to separate anything in my life. It's all together. I don't know where my art begins and my life begins.
You're not a compartmentalizer anyway.
Exactly. It's all meshed together. And so even my practice that does use multiple mediums, I'm more interested in the practice and the act of making rather than the product, you know. And the product is hyper embedded in materials, you know. And so I think that the materials are what I have access to. It's whatever's around me. And in that space, I think that's a very customary practice of Indigenous people.
Using what's on hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's not just you creating, though. It seems like you get a lot of other people involved with your work. Can you tell us about the process?
Yeah, definitely. It goes back to the process, right? Like the institutions that, you know, carry and maintain art want to celebrate individuals. I mean, I'm here now as a single person engaging with your community. And one thing that I realized was that because art is a practice, if I could share that, the process of making, then that's a way to actually share what I believe art is. And art to me is a verb and not a noun. And so, the exchange of art as an object, you know, is a commodification process. But if we share the practice of making, then everybody who participates becomes the owner of the work in a way that it doesn't need to be possessed in order to have a relationship to it.
That's a great phrase. Art is a verb, not a noun, and it makes me think in terms of the fact that you're always creating art. I mean, this is one of the benefits of not compartmentalizing your life, is that pretty much anything you do can be viewed as art.
Yeah, absolutely, but you lose the weekend, you know. I never know what day of the week it is. I have to work by the date so that I can get to places on time.
We're talking to Chinupa Hanska Luger here on the Jefferson Exchange, an artist visiting the University of Oregon in Eugene. A couple of sessions, including one tomorrow at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History, noon to 5. Chinupa, can you tell us about some of the recent projects, like the MMIWQT bead project?
Yeah, certainly. This project started off as an exhibition that was called Lazy Stitch, and it was an exhibition that I put together to try to figure out how to get an artist to curate a show. And in that process, most institutions have curators, so they're not really interested in artists making the selection of works that will go into an exhibition. But I found a loophole in that, which was collaboration. If I could collaborate with every artist that I wanted to have in the exhibition, then all of the works that we produced would be curated by me, you know? And so in that process, I started working with a queer photographer from Northwest Territories in Canada. Her name is Kaylee Spitzer, and she does these beautiful tintype photography, which, if you're familiar with them, they're these, you know, turn of the century or 1800, like beautiful, rich black and white photographs. Anyway, Kaylee had been doing work around like matriarchal systems and developing strong women and women representations within Indigenous art and within photography. And we started collaborating on a project, and I was asking Kaylee, like, what should we emphasize as the core of our project? And Kaylee's interest, and also my own interest, but was embedded in data gathered in Canada with the missing and murdered Indigenous women. Because of the Truth and Reconciliation Acts that have been passed in Canada, the grassroots organizations basically had had the teeth to ask law enforcement to gather data, or at least have a government help produce, like, accurate, you know, a more accurate sense of what that data is. But the grassroots organizations would basically go to each community and make record of women that were missing and or murdered. And due to that data, there was, had been, like, mapping that took place, as well as safeguards and protocols within a legal system to help protect this epidemic in Indian country. And so I was looking at that data, and that data said 4,000, and it was a nice round number, and that was kind of concerning to me, because there's no way that it's exactly 4,000. And if we're talking about a body lost, to come up with a nice round data number like 4,000, you have to either remove some of the bodies that were lost or add some. And that is problematic. You know what I'm saying? It's the coldness of data. So I wanted to figure out a way to, like, rehumanize those numbers. And so working with Kaylee, we decided that Kaylee would make a photograph that would represent the issue, and I would reproduce that photograph in at scale using 4,000 individual hand-built beads. I started the process, and it became very prayer-like, where, you know, the repetition of saying, you know, this is already too many, this is enough, this must stop, one, you know, and doing this over and over and over again, I recognized how implicated I was in the epidemic of missing and murdered, that I was implicated in my complacency, that I had just built a deck out of timber from Canada, and that the extractive industries basically create a thoroughfare for the annihilation of matriarchy and matricide within Indigenous communities. And so it became cathartic. You know, 3 days in, I had made like 60 some beads, and thought about it, you know, along the way, saying, you know, this prayer over and over and over again, and I experienced every emotion that my body could produce, and it became a sort of catharsis, where I was like, I'm implicated, I'm also doing something, I'm also trying to figure out a way to amplify this problem and magnify the voices that it represents. And so I realized that the making of the beads and that process was the most beautiful that this piece could ever be. And so I made a video and shared it on social media, and reduced how the beads were made actually to the simplest possible form, which is a 2-inch ball of clay with a hole in it, thinking that if I made this video and made a call to action, people who wanted to get involved could embed their activism in their muscle memory rather than just liking and sharing through social media outlets.
Oh, a physical representation then.
Exactly. And so 3 months in, there were like 3,928 beads in just 3 months from communities all across North America. And they were, you know, sent with photos of small groups working together around kitchen tables, and major institutions working with their community to produce beads. And in each one of those boxes that got sent to me, these were unfired clay beads, and there were letters in a lot of these boxes. And the thing that hit most hard is that in these letters, you know, they was saying, you know, one of these beads in this box represents my mom. You know, one of these beads in this box represents my auntie, my sister, my cousin, my friend, you know. And so I was beginning to get an emotional and empathetic scale of the extent of this matricide.
So catharsis, not just for you, but for all those people who sent in the beads as well.
I think that's what's embedded in the practice, right? Like, that's why art is a process and not a noun. That in the making, there is a place to put your trauma so that you don't pass it on to future generations.
Our guest is Chinupa Hanska-Luger here on the Jefferson Exchange, an artist visiting the University of Oregon this weekend. One of the items coming up tomorrow is a workshop on making seed bombs, which I talked about at the outset. I want to let people know there's no gunpowder involved, but what is a seed bomb?
So a seed bomb is a ball of earth, basically, with a few seeds embedded in it, like indigenous seeds to the region. We're using a couple of grasses and a sedge to basically it allows you to plant seeds in locations that may be difficult to access. So oftentimes, they had been used to plant flowers and like wildflowers and whatnot in like interstate medians, or to launch them over walls and plant wildflowers within guarded areas. So it's a really simple way to reestablish some sort of like indigeneity, like nativeness to the landscape, and with those seeds comes a tropic cascade, where by planting some of these things, you create refuge for birds, and these birds can then create shelter and nest for themselves in a more customary relationship. Like they're familiar with these grasses, and they have a long relationship of producing houses, and in that they also can plant acorns and rebuild oak forests and fix river systems. There's an aspect to reestablishing the indigenous plant life that can help facilitate on ways that is really difficult for us to comprehend. And so the seed bomb itself is literally a ball of dirt and clay that's about the size of a nickel, and can be launched with your hand. You can throw them, but it's a way to plant seeds in hard to reach locations.
Wow, it is that small then. Okay, I was thinking something along the lines of a hand grenade size, but I guess I was thinking too much in terms of explosives. Let me emphasize again, seed bombs are not explosive. They are small and just meant to distribute seeds, but an amazing kind of artwork, if you could even call it artwork. But as you pointed out, art is a verb, not a noun. Our guest is Chinupa Hanska-Luger. He's visiting the University of Oregon this weekend with some events, including tomorrow, noon to 5, at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.